This interview with Professor Lawrence Schiffman of New York University was recorded in November 2008.
I'm really not exactly a Bible scholar because I'm a Dead Sea Scrolls scholar, and most people think that's a kind of Bible scholar because we're really dealing with the earliest documents that interpret and expand on the Bible, and we have much of the same training. But as a result of that, most of the things that I teach are actually post-biblical. I teach Dead Sea Scrolls to undergraduates in English translation. I teach them to graduate students in our PhD program in the original. We have a number of other courses in scrolls taught by people other than me. I also teach some rabbinic literature and early Jewish history and late antiquity as well. But then on the undergraduate level, I also often do the ancient Israel course, which is really a biblical studies type of a course in that it's telling the history of Israel in the biblical period. So you could say in some ways that I'm a half Bible scholar.
Tell me about the ancient languages you needed to learn to do your work.
Well, the languages that I really use are Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek. I also studied Latin, Akkadian, Ugaritic, and of course, Phoenician inscriptions and stuff like that. So I did the full gamut of all these language studies.
So tell me, what's a typical work day like for you?
Well, my day is a funny kind of a day because I'm also an administrator. I'm chair of a department, but it's a department which is sort of a conglomerate because we have underneath us a number of sub-institutes and other types of activities. So for better or for worse, I could spend the first half of the day answering emails, making calls, whether I'm in my office or at home. But on some days, I'm in my office, and then I'm spending my time teaching my classes, meeting students, undergraduate and graduate, helping them with their papers, often helping them with some of their career choices and other things like that that they have to work with, especially with graduate students. It's an enormous amount of effort that you put into helping your graduate students to move in the right direction, not only in terms of their actual courses and what they study, but all of these career decisions. And then what I do is I try to save some other days when I'm home. Days when I'm home is when, at least once I finish the emails and stuff of the administrative activity, I'm really able to work on my research. One of my tricks is to commit myself for a lot of papers, and then worst comes to worst, I have to stay up all night and do it. For which reason, in my own situation, I have a rather big library at home. So I can do almost everything I need to do without going out of my house, and I will spend whole days doing that. Also, people don't realize this. People spend their time on weekends. A lot of students don't get this exactly. You know, you talk about some of these lawyers and doctors that work these crazy hours, but we also work these crazy hours because I know people are always asking, do you have to publish? They don't really get it. You don't do this if you don't want to publish. It's not that you have to publish. It's what are you doing next and how fast can you get it done and making sure that it's good. And that's the real thing that we do, basically. We teach and we do research.
So how exactly do you go about doing your research?
Well, I'm usually working at a laptop with a second screen because that way I can do two things at once. And most of what I'm doing is out of books and photographs of scrolls. When you need to consult the actual scroll, you've got to go to Jerusalem. This we do when we're publishing a scroll and we have a particular problem that we have to examine. But most of my research can be done out of a book, and when I need to see the pictures, I've got them all there in one form or another, or I have them on my computer. But the thing is that you need to consult a lot of books. So my trick is I take out all the books one by one, and then as I'm writing, I put them back. And then when the books aren't there anymore, I've written the paragraph or the footnote or whatever it is. And I find the whole trick is making sure you know what it is you want to write before you start. Otherwise, you're sitting around there all day. For example, at this conference, I gave a paper on the issue of exile and return in the Dead Sea Scrolls. At this program, they had two sessions, actually, about exile and return, mostly the Hebrew Bible. So what I was able to do on that was started reading. I read a whole lot of articles and things like that, which mostly had to do with the biblical period. One or two articles about the same theme of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And then it came time to starting to write. Well, at the beginning, I had no idea what to write because my problem was, how do I want to organize it? So instead of jumping in and started writing some stuff and it's all going to be no good, that isn't worth it. I actually just gave it a little time.
So that's my next question, is about your scholarship and what are you currently working on that you find really compelling and interesting? What's an interesting question or problem for you?
I continue to be over and over and over trying to take out of the Dead Sea Scrolls what you might call generalities about what these people really believed and where it fit within the wider sort of atmosphere of Judaism at the time, and hence how it might help us to understand later Judaism and the rise of Christianity, or early Christianity, however you want to look at it. This theme seems to me to be, for me, the most important thing that I work on. And placing these things in context and understanding more and more what that context is for me the main thing that I do. Now, some other people might think other things are more important. I don't argue with them. But this seems to be what I do. And it doesn't matter what question it is, whether it's the exile and return thing that I just did, or to give you something which is diametrically opposed. I'm part of a project now, which is one part of the editorial group of a project to produce a theological dictionary of the Dead Sea Scrolls. So we had a small conference in Bonn, Germany. And I was asked to give a paper, and I finally figured out what to do. And I gave a paper on the Jewish law terminology of the scrolls. And I sat down, and I started going through texts and writing definitions and explanations. This is a biblical term. This is not a biblical term. This term is also found in rabbinic literature. This term is not found in rabbinic literature. This term has a parallel in Greek. This does not have a parallel in Greek. By the time I went through several hundred, which is what I had in the end, it was impossible to read this paper. You know, this word, this word. It was a real bored read. But by the time I went through several hundred terms, I realized a tremendous amount about the nature of this terminology. But in the end, it still answered that same question, because look what I had done. I had placed the material in relation to how it is or is not based on Hebrew Bible. I had looked at the fact that it relates to later Judaism and how. And in some examples, even though it's legal terminology, it actually even related to issues in Christianity.
So how do you move from studying a text to offering a creative insight about the text?
The first thing is you have to know something. One of the biggest problems that we have is we have a lot of people trying to do research without having any information before they start. Now, you have to spend a lot of your time, although I didn't mention it before, just learning and studying. If you teach graduate students, it's much easier. Because after all, you teach these graduate classes. I never teach the same texts, almost never. I teach all kinds of different things. I give seminars on different things. I have students who come to see me about their own dissertations or piles of reading lists that they're working on. So this way, it makes it much easier to keep up. And the truth is that as you get older, your bibliography is behind. You learned all your stuff from old books. The students come in, they say, hey, what about so-and-so? And I know so-and-so is. Maybe I didn't read his work. Maybe I didn't read his work. So, okay, I find out what the latest up-to-date thing is. If it's worth it, I go out and read it now. But if you don't keep yourself up on the literature and what's going on in the field, then you don't know anything and you can't even start to know what to do. And also in the study of texts, to keep studying the Bible, you have to keep studying, in my case, the scrolls, other later Jewish texts, New Testament texts. If you don't do that, then your brain isn't going to work that way. And then the other thing you've got to do is you've got to read some basic, very important scholarship before you try to do anything. Because then it percolates in your mind somehow. The other people said things which help to inform how you're going to figure out where you want to go. And this is something which it's hard to explain sometimes, because sometimes the percolation can happen when you're driving in the car. And it doesn't work to sit in front of your computer. You may as well read the newspaper. It's not going to work that way. The human brain doesn't work that way. That's why I tell students when they're trying to come up with their dissertation topic, don't do all your exams and then come into me and say, okay, now I need a topic. Well, it's going to take you 6 weeks to even know, because you think a little here and a little here, and you read one book in the library there, another book there. So that's a very important thing. So by looking at the work of important scholars in allied areas, you get a sense of how to go. And categorization you often can get by looking at religious studies, how people in that field have looked at, for the sake of argument, redemption in Buddhism or something like that. You know, because you want to write an article on redemption. But what do they think about it? And it may be totally irrelevant to the situation we're talking about, but there's a set of categories. Once you know the set of categories, then you're ready to go. My process is don't take notes and don't write anything if you don't know what you wanted. By which I mean to say, if you haven't decided yet whether there's going to be a section in your paper about, you know, the book of Deuteronomy and this problem, then don't write one, because you don't know if you want it or not. Now, for me, it all starts with the Bible. That's why people say we're Bible scholars. So I've got to see what's the biblical information on this topic. And then you've got to look at a whole bunch of different commentaries and stuff. And then you go from there. And one of the things you have to do always is allow your own imagination to determine what you really think it means, not in an uncontrolled manner, but, you know, within reason. And I guess that's what your job is, and always to know that you're trying to build up a general picture. Trivia are great. If you don't have trivia, then you're in the wrong place. You come to a meeting of the SBL, right? You're here for trivia. You're not here for some kind of public lectures, you know? So trivia are great, but then you want to know what do the trivia mean.
So you want a sort of a systematic...
Yeah, systematic arrangement of the trivia, integrating them in a way that they will lead to the conclusion that you think is correct. Now, sometimes you know in advance, so you can arrange the trivia, so to speak, that way. Admittedly, sometimes you figure out when you get to the end, well, okay, I had the wrong arrangement. Good, then you change it. But if you had no arrangement, it's just all over the place.
I can't get out of my head what you said earlier about finding an organizing theme for Exile and Return. What was it in the end?
Here's the really interesting thing. We know historically there was an exile. We can talk about the Assyrian exile, but in a certain sense, the Assyrian and Babylonian exile, it's sort of like one big phenomenon, because between 722 and 586 BCE, some number of Israelites and Judeans are moved out of the country elsewhere, and those who stay, and there's a lot of debate about the extent of what happened and how, but they certainly were victimized by terrible circumstances. Even if they did recover quickly, we don't know if it affected everybody, but it massive wars took place. Many people were killed and much was destroyed. Now, what's really interesting is for us, there are basically, I'd say, two restorations. There's a Persian period return, 540 BCE. By 520, there's a temple. And then, eventually, the Romans come along. And shortly after the life and career of Jesus, in 70, they destroy the temple. And I don't know if you would call it an exile, but later Judaism calls it an exile, because it's sort of on the pattern of the first, even if the population wasn't removed, but it caused the population to go way down. Now, there's a lot of discussion about what is exile in the Bible, and there is today this whole new field of discussing mass migrations and forced migrations, sociology, it's interesting stuff. But what I found from my material was something radically different. There is a fundamental assumption in literature written immediately after the Bible, some written by the Qumran sectarians and some written by their predecessors, which says there was no return under the Persians. What does that mean? It doesn't mean they don't say people came. They know people came. But it's all not legitimate, because exile is not physical removal anymore. Exile, as it is in later Judaism, is a state of being, of being separated because of your transgressions from God. And God, as the term goes, turning his face and allowing others to come and destroy you. And once that happens, there is no return until you've repented. So for the Qumran sectarians and a lot of the books that they read, the return is what happens when the Messiah is going to come, the end of days. The eschaton is the return. So they're living in a land of Israel, in Hellenistic and Roman times, sometimes even under a Jewish king, Herod, and they're living there as if they're in exile. However, we actually have some religious groups in Judaism today that are living in the state of Israel as if they're in exile. It's exactly the same phenomenon. And the honest truth is that the whole Jewish community prays as if they're still in exile. The prayers talk about the state of exile, because the state of exile is the fact that there isn't a spiritual perfection. So you see that these sectarians were really hooked on that idea that the Persian period return meant nothing. But now here's another interesting fact. Whereas the pre-Qumran type Second Temple texts talk about the return as not being legitimate, the eventual return, or what we sometimes call restoration, will be for all Jews, or even in some texts, for the whole world. Not these guys. The Qumran sectarians, only they are going to be there at the return. Everybody else is going to be destroyed. So you have the sectarianization of even what appears to be a radical notion that the Persian period return is not a return. So it gets worse and worse. And you see that in these texts. That, by the way, is one of the reasons why you have to contrast this so much with Christianity. Some of these early scholars who were convinced that this was just like Christianity, they're all wrong, because Christianity, like all forms of Judaism that we know, assumes that redemption is for the whole world, and anybody who wants to be a good person is going to be in on it. Now, there are all these ideas about messianic wars that you find in some texts, but they always assume that most people are good people. There happen to be a few bad people that have to be gotten rid of to have a perfect world, and they really deserve it because they're really terrible. So that's what they assume.
Is there received wisdom about the Bible that you like to shed a slightly different light on?
Received wisdom about the Bible I want to shed a different light on. Yeah, right. Let me make two points in this regard. One is that I think it's a very big mistake to think that we can possibly get back to the original Bible. This is exceedingly naive. It's naive because the text that we have that was transmitted to us is from a period which is much after, even the Dead Sea Scrolls. And because the process of interpretation and development is constant, and because the Bible is so much a part of modern life, whether people are religious or they're not religious, if you're a part of Western culture, it's so much a part of modern life that it is not possible to really get back to its origins. And sometimes you go into sessions at these meetings and people are thinking that they are really telling you what Jeremiah said and thought without realizing that the overlays on it are tremendous. So we have to understand that we're talking about a Western cultural monument in a certain sense, which is part of the sort of combined religious traditions. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to get as close to what it was as we can, but even that represents a combination of us and them. And we have to realize all the time that we are in this and that we ourselves are part of a process of making the Bible something for a modern person and not think that I really got down there to 7th century BCE, let alone, you know, 1200 BCE.
So we're reading into interpretations, really.
It's not just even when we try not to, the act of being objective is itself a form of being an interpreter. Now, I'm not suggesting some kind of postmodern idea that there is no meaning. And, you know, it's fine if you say that Hero Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one, doesn't really mean that it's one because it means that there's a masculine and a feminine God and they're all equally valid or something like that. Right? Then this is clearly reading into whole concepts which are nowhere in the text. I don't mean that. I mean that the subtle and competent scholar who has read all these ancient Near Eastern texts and done all this stuff to try and interpret the Bible has to understand that what comes out in the end represents our way of coming with objective scholarship to the biblical text. It doesn't represent some kind of claimed, assumed, original. This naivete, I think, requires some type of humility. That's one thing. The second thing is, and this is kind of an easy pot shot to take, but that I think that the trends that are going on towards minimalism sound good, even though one by one by one, things happen to disprove it. People told us there was no David. Suddenly they find a House of David inscription. So, okay, they said, listen, you can't prove that David lived. You can only prove that in the 800s they thought he lived. Okay, I admit that. That's pretty good. Okay, what do we need? Then they said, yeah, but you got to know nobody really lived in Judea. It was really a dump, and nobody built anything there. King David was some kind of a village emir or something like that, right? Suddenly, before you know it, they find this gigantic building in Jerusalem. Okay, they say it's the capital. Maybe it's not. Then they come along, no, that's a Hellenistic building. It's not a Hellenistic building. Then they go out and they find this other place, right, with this inscription from 1000 BCE. In other words, the notion that you can just keep going for some reasons which are not clear, to keep claiming that the Bible represents no facticity, even after we historically analyze it and strip away layers of development and whatever, right? This seems to me to have turned into a sort of a cult. And I think it's time to get back to the reality that when you look at any text, and this includes the Bible, you're dealing with a situation in which you have to analyze in a historical manner. You have to use all the evidence you have, the Bible, archaeology, other texts, your own critical sense, but that doesn't mean that there's no facticity in this thing. And I think people need to sort of get back to that. And we hear so many sessions where it's just an assumption that whatever it says there can't possibly be true.
And finally, what are some of the core values, skills, or habits of mind that you think are required to be a Bible scholar?
Well, the first thing that you need to be a scholar of any kind is you have to be able to sit in one place for a long time. You have to decide if you like to sit and read, and then you have to see whether or not you come up with original ideas. If you can't come up with original ideas, it's hopeless. That's the first thing. Second of all, no one should go into scholarship who's not willing to be corrected, even if you're correcting yourself. As you learn more, you find what I thought before might not be right. Or I came and I gave a paper, and luckily I haven't published it yet, and people tell me, hey, what about this? What about that? Go back and you fix it. If you don't really want an exchange of ideas, You might succeed, but you're probably making a mistake. Another very important thing is that someone who goes into this field is to be very exacting, because much of what they're going to look at is very, very minor details on which they have to build up their picture. If they don't build it on that, it's not real research. It's just talk. So if you don't like details, it's not for you. Then you have to be willing to place scholarship ahead of recreation. It doesn't mean to do no recreation, but the notion that you're going to be like a person who comes home from work, turns on the TV, watches ball games all night, and then Saturday night, Sunday, maybe goes to a variety of, between family events, concerts, sport, you know, sports events, you know, usual thing, right? And now you filled up all your time with that, and you read the Sunday Times from cover to cover and stuff like that, and, you know, just you're going to do your research, we 9 to 5 on 5 days, we forget it, you're going to the wrong field.